Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm one of the show's hosts, Kevin Gastola, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Kala Nakua, who is a freelance criminal justice reporter and also an organizer with the National Writers Union, who has joined me to discuss a report that was put together by the National Writers Union called Red Lines in the Media Industry During the War on Gaza. I'll go ahead and just put this report up here so people can see it. This is a website that is hosted on NWU.org's website. It's a page. The report is hosted on their website. And so welcome. I appreciate you joining me to discuss what's been unfolding in the industry for writers over the last 7 to 8 months.
Thank you for having me.
And in particular, let's just begin by giving people just, you don't have to say a lot about yourself, mm-hmm. but I would appreciate it since, you know, I haven't had an opportunity to meet you before. Mm-hmm. If you could maybe share a little bit about getting involved in criminal justice reporting, mm-hmm. what brought you to the profession. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason why I would begin there is because obviously what we're talking about is people being deprived of the opportunity to perform their craft or do what they were trained to do, all because they were expressing a political viewpoint.
I have always wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be a journalist when I was 13, and it was due to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. I was pretty upset by it and was pretty upset by the way it was covered. And so it sort of, in a way, inspired me to become a journalist and to really hone in my craft as a journalist. And then a couple of years ago, I started to really think about criminal justice reform, and it really started with a story that I was looking into regarding a case in Alabama where a Muslim incarcerated person wanted to have like an imam in his like on the day of his execution to have, instead of a priest, he has an imam, and the prison would not allow him to do that. And so that was really, to me, it was such a small thing. Like, he wasn't asking for much, and the fact that he didn't get it, and the fact that it got like national attention, went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and he still lost. It just stuck with me, and so I decided after that I wanted to look into the criminal justice system, both in the U.S. and also, because I'm based in Canada, also looking into it in the looking into the Canadian prisons.
So let's just get into this report that examines, these are members, these people who were surveyed by the National Writers Union, these are people who are members of the National Writers Union, correct?
No. No. Some of them are, but they're like, a lot of them are not members of the National Writers Union.
For full uncut episodes of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast, go to patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure or go to thedissenter.org and become a subscriber. Okay, so these are people that you were able to reach out to, and I know that part of the report, I should tell those who are viewing and or listening, mm-hmm. that there were a couple surveys that were conducted in order to compile information. So rather than have me speak for you, because you were involved, before we get into the examples of retaliation, mm-hmm. you speak about what led to this mm-hmm. report and the way it was conducted by National Writers Union to go around and, you know, ask people a couple important questions mm-hmm. about things that face the profession right now.
So shortly after October 7th attack, members of the National Writers Union, including myself, noticed this pattern of, media workers being retaliated against for either speaking up in support of Palestinians, criticizing the Israeli government, or signing open letters demanding an end to the killing of Palestinian journalists in Gaza. And after hearing, multiple of these cases, we thought as a union that this is a very important issue for us to tackle because it's both a labor issue as well as a journalistic issue. And so we decided to, collect these cases and compile them into a report that showcases, that this really is a systemic problem that's happening throughout the industry, that it's not like one industry, one news outlets that's doing this. It's multiple news outlets that are doing this. And so our main objective of the report was to highlight the urgent need of for equitable, inclusive, transparent, and democratic process when dealing with potential violations in the workplace for greater clarity and reasonable protections around free expression for media workers.
That's very good, and it's very detailed, and the report digs into the different examples and types of retaliation that can be faced. Oh, I imagine that most people out there understand retaliation to be termination or being fired and no longer being able to work as a professional in what you were trained to do. These aren't only writers, some of them are staffers or personnel, or they could be editors for publications that have experienced difficulties and then had to leave their position. But there are also different other ways that people have faced retaliation. Perhaps you want to speak to people about the different example or the different types of retaliation that were covered in your report.
Yeah, so we have a huge list of the types of retaliation. So on this list, we have cancellation of appearances slash events. We have cancellation of assignments, assignment restrictions, terminations, resignations, social media suppression, online harassment, and award rescinded.
I'll put these up for you. Didn't want to like make this a memory test for you.
Yeah.
So I put some examples I pulled from, and this is from the National Writers Union report. So you do a good job of linking so that people can see that some of these examples of retaliation did make the news. I mean, I guess in some instances they were undercovered and people might not know that those people faced retaliation. But in this case, we have a cartoonist who was under contract named Steve Bell, who was working for The Guardian and did a cartoon on Netanyahu. I don't know if there's anything you wanted to say about these particular examples. Then there's also, and this one, being that it's in Canada, maybe you'd have more to say about this one, but a Palestinian journalist who was fired from CTV in Canada for pro-Palestinian activism. This was covered by The Rabble. Yara Jamal said that her complaints about workplace harassment were ignored, but that she was quickly fired for statements she made outside of work. So in this instance, it would seem that, and this happens in several examples, you're seeing a double standard in the way that people are treated. So their complaints about something at the outlet or the organization that they work for go unheard and they aren't attended to. And then when it comes to complaints about their speech, there's an immediate response by management.
Yeah, definitely. There's one case that struck me actually when you were mentioning the cases that I was thinking about was there was a social like when it falls through social media suppression, there was this group told the CAMRA, which stands for the Committee for Accuracy in Media in Middle East Reporting in America. However, they're often a group that's just dedicated to what they claim to be anti-Israel bias. And they targeted the social media accounts of six Middle Eastern staffers at the BBC and one freelancer who works at the BBC. And after this, you know, the BBC responded by saying that they are launching an investigation, and they removed the reporters off the air and decided that the freelance reporter that they were working with previously, that they were no longer going to work with them in future projects. And so those are sort of the types of cases that sort of struck in my mind when we were collecting these reports, that it often is an outside party sort of saying that these social media accounts are problematic, and then the news outlet would respond by either forcing them out or, yeah, like any form of retaliation.
Right. And one thing that those following this issue have possibly observed or might remember is that these outside groups, as they have targeted students at colleges or universities, are doing doxing, are trying to put personal identifying information online that'll make it difficult for them to get jobs later. That kind of an attack, it as I read your report, there have been several examples where people working in media have had to deal with that kind of a mob-like behavior of individuals trying to stop someone from being employed again.
Yeah, it's definitely something that we're noticing a lot, even after. So like our report, we stopped the limit of cases when it comes to February 1st. However, we're still noticing mass of retaliation, and given what's going on with student journalism, we also see that there's a connection between the way news outlets are retaliating towards their journalists and the way, you know, the violence towards, you know, student journalists who are just covering and just doing their jobs.
As you mentioned earlier, we've seen over 100 journalists in Gaza who've been killed, at least. That number could be a little bit higher. I think some of it depends on confirmation of how people have died, and also it depends on how some of these organizations classify journalists or classify people as being involved in this professional work. And that being said, there were a number of open letters that were organized in October. There might have been a few in November, but really and truly in that first month of the war on Gaza, there were open letters and professionals decided to sign on. We have one example that I could put up here before I ask you about this retaliation around open letters. You had at the Art Forum, there was a editor who worked on the open letter that artists had signed. In fact, I jotted down here from the report that he was fired, David Velasco, after overseeing the open letter that was signed by 8,000 plus artists and cultural workers. So, that's a pretty good sized group of people to be brought in and speak out from within the cultural industry. And so your reaction to finding these examples of people who were retaliated against because they put their names to open letters?
One of the things that we found pretty troubling was the fact that people were being retaliated against for signing an open letter that hasn't occurred in other issues. So for it, like even in 2021, when there was another open letter regarding fair coverage with Palestine and Israel, not that many people experienced retaliation after that. And so now that like in this case, there are there is retaliation if you sign open letters. And not only that, you have news outlets that are trying to make policies, making sure that, you know, if you do sign an open letter, that there will be consequences, which is very, to me, is very unsettling and has an unsettling feel to it. Obviously, the most memorable case of this was regarding the LA Times when they removed 38 journalists. I believe some of them were covering the war in Gaza, but I'm not 100% sure, and that they sort of removed them from covering anything relating to Israel and Palestine. Just as a fundamental view, do not agree with the idea of journalists being retaliated against for signing open letters, especially when it's an open letter just saying that Palestinian journalists should not be killed.
Right. As it says in the report, there were past campaigns decrying the targeting of journalists by other hostile governments that have enjoyed widespread support. So the standard is not being applied evenly. And, you know, as people might suspect, the report does attend to the fact that there has been expressions of support for Israel's campaign in Gaza, its military operations, and those media workers have not been told that they should be reassigned or lost jobs because they are taking a position and are no longer, I guess, neutral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely there is a bias, and there is sort of a double standard when it comes to bias, that, you know, people who tend to have more pro-Israel views are not being asked to be objective when it comes to this issue, or not being asked to be fair. And while, you know, those who have more leaning Palestinian views or solidarity with Palestinians are often told that they can't cover this issue, or they can't cover anything even relating to the encampments at universities now. And we definitely, as a union, do vehemently disagree and vehemently against this double standard of bias.
I also want to make sure that I get your response to how this has disproportionately affected people of color who work in this profession, because that was an element of the report. So it's pointed out that many of these examples involve Middle Eastern or North African descent, people of that descent.
Yeah, so we fact-checked and researched 44 cases that involved more than 100 people that occurred between October 7th to February 1st. And what we found that was very stark was the fact that Muslims and those who are from Middle Eastern and North African descent were disproportionately targeted. 38% of the cases that we found involved a Muslim or MENA worker being retaliated against.
For full uncut episodes of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast, go to patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure or go to thedissenter.org and become a subscriber. And let me put out, I'll play this example is, you know, of somebody who fits this. And that was Zahra Al-Akris, who was retaliated against, and then after facing retaliation for social media posts, went on Instagram to share a response to what she endured. So let me put this up here.
I'm a Palestinian Canadian journalist. From October 7, I started posting on my social media accounts. My posts were seen as unfair and unbalanced according to some selective, biased, racist standards. I was terminated from my job. This was such a shock to me as a racialized journalist, as someone who actually believed in this organization. I'm the fourth generation Palestinian who was forcibly displaced from Palestine due to the occupation. My family comes from Hebron, West Bank. I felt as a Palestinian, as a human being, this is a situation where I cannot afford to stay silent. Just as we spoke up about Ukraine, just as we condemned Putin's invasion of Ukraine, we must speak up in this situation. And things have escalated from that moment on. My direct manager reached out and asked me to stop posting because they have received a complaint. I recommended that I delete everything I have been posting. I mainly was sharing a criticism of Western media's coverage. I was sharing criticism of government's response to what's going on the ground. I was sharing scenes from the ground. I replied to my manager, explaining to him my situation. I said that I hope I can come to an agreement with the company to preserve my right to speak up about my people, about the injustice that is happening to my people. I received another email from a workplace investigator from the Ethics and Conduct Office at the parent company. So I replied to her and sent her a screenshot of a dead Gazan baby in hospital. And I explained to her that this image has been my reality for a week at that time. And this has been the reality of my people for years. And I would hope that someone in this organization would understand, would actually ask me, how am I doing at least? Unfortunately, that workplace investigator took issue with me sending her a disturbing image as she considered it. I received a final notice to remove everything I have been posting and to stop posting whatsoever in the future. I inquired at least 3 times about the specific posts the company wants me to take down, and I asked them to present me with a clear argument as to why these posts are seen as a violation of their policy. I was never provided with any links. I was only told that my overall posts give the perception of bias according to some people, and that is why they terminated my employment. They terminated me based on the assumption that I refused to comply, although their request was not clear to me. This is written in my termination notice, that I violated their respect in the workplace policy by sending a graphic image to an employee. The whole process was arbitrary. To me, this was punishment for my stance. They actually offered me money to stay silent about their decision to terminate me. I risked it because people are literally dying before our eyes. It means nothing if I lost my job. I could just find another one tomorrow. Whatever people outside of Gaza do to amplify the voices of Palestinians under Israeli bombardment right now is the least, the bare minimum any human being can do, because governments are failing the Palestinians.
Your response to what Zahra was sharing?
It's so, like, for me, disheartening that a journalist was, you know, doing her job, you know, posting on social media, and then she was terminated for it. I do think one thing that we did always, we underscored as well in the report, was that, you know, social media policies are often sparse when it comes to news outlets, that there is no really like indication on like what is considered political speech, what is something that like what are journalists like, you know, can post and cannot post. And so this has been an issue for a couple of years, unlike the issue when it comes to social media and journalism, and And it is something that I found in a lot of cases that social media is one of, you know, social media suppression, either by a news outlet or by, you know, outside parties, are one of like the most, like, of the cases. It's one of like the most cases that we have found during the, like these months.
Zara was on maternity leave when this happened. That was according to your report. So anyone who's a professional would, you know, recognize that that's not a time that you want to be reassessing what you're going to do as your employment. What has the National Writers Union come to understand when it comes to objectivity?
We sort of, when discussing objectivity, I think, you know, for years we have invoked objectivity as a professional responsibility. However, in our analysis, we found that a lot of what we claim as objectivity is really subjective, and it really dominates, you know, and like it reinforces a dominant narrative, while the perspective of marginalized groups are often likely considered fringe or biased. And so you're seeing this in a lot of cases where journalists who are Middle Eastern descent, or, you know, other journalists of colors, of color, when they express, you know, like the idea of fair coverage in when regards to Palestine or Black Lives Matter, and they are often deemed as being biased for doing so. While, like, of course, like going back to the New York Times, like this, like the issue with that article was that of, like, the journalist that wrote it did have a very, you know, negative perception of Palestinians, and that then, like, you know, and it was very it was very public. And so the fact that she was still allowed to write this article with that bias, while, like, other journalists of color, that if they have a bias like that, they wouldn't be allowed to write an article like that. And so we believe that, like, there should be, like, a new view of objectivity in a new way that we think of objectivity in this industry. And so, like, it's bad enough that there's been massive layoffs in so many news outlets, but this just then adds to, like, the retaliation just adds to more loss of journalists that we badly need in this moment.
For full uncut episodes of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast, go to patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure or go to thedissenter.org and become a subscriber. Finally, but before I let you go, and thank you for speaking to me about this important trend, alarming trend that we have to do everything we can to push back against. I would like to hear your thoughts as we conclude on the difficulty, or the way that it's become controversial to speak up for journalists in Gaza who have been killed, and how, you know, that's needlessly politicized. We've hinted at it. We've spoke a little bit about it, but the larger context for me is viewing the destruction that we've seen in Gaza and recognizing that all this culture has been destroyed, that you've lost art, you've lost, you know, if it's an art gallery, it's probably been attacked by Israeli military at this point. All the universities and colleges that have been flattened or turned into rubble. And so, you know, it seems to me that for writers who are speaking up, there's something, it's something more than a lot of various conflicts where or wars where you're speaking out against individuals who have been killed. In this instance, it's the erasure of artwork. It's the erasure of cultural past, cultural histories, artifacts being lost, etc.
I feel like due to this heightened retaliation, it just made a lot of people more realizing of like how terrible this issue is, and so so people want to like speak up about it, even regarding even if it affects their careers. Like, I think this is something that you're noticing with university students, that like, you know, these are young students who are sort of at the start of their adulthood, and they are, you know, joining these encampments and doing all this stuff, despite that it may like affect their careers, and they really kind of don't care, or it's not like it in their primary mind when they're thinking about this and when they're thinking about joining. And I do feel like this erasure of culture and art and universities and writing, and the fact that like you're having like close to like or more than like 100 journalists in Gaza have been killed, and so many writers and academics have been killed, is something that should make all of us, you know, angry and upset, and that we it has sort of been interesting sort of seeing the fact that we've made it controversial and sort of this war culture type of issue when it shouldn't have been, you know, especially as like journalists, like we should be upset that this conflict has led to killings of so many journalists that no other conflict has ever led. Like no like war or atrocities or genocides have ever led to this many journalists being killed, and that is like really upsetting, and like our ignoring it or are not talking about it is to me very stark and goes against the idea of like journalism is not a crime, which we keep constantly hammering, which obviously like I believe in, like I've always believed in this, and I've always criticized countries that don't have strong press freedom policies. But this is also the same thing, that if a country is brutally killing journalists without impunity, which first is like against international law, and second, it's something that we should all be against by, like, you know, the protection of journalists, the protection of the truth is something that like we should all advocate for, even though like I know advocacy is something that journalists always get uncomfortable with, but that is like one type of advocacy that we should all agree in.
Right. So like when you work in this profession and you advocate for freedom of the press, or you advocate for journalistic protections to what you do as a worker, that has for the most part been seen as acceptable. And, you know, I don't think there are many editorial boards that would be upset that you advocate for, you know, equality and justice when it comes to performing journalism. And yet we see these examples. So since you and I share this, which is my coming into this space comes from the Iraq War as well. And that was a time when journalists were pulled into defending and helping the U.S. government justify what they were doing. And then in retrospect, it's very difficult for anybody in journalism or writing to publish defenses of the U.S. invasion into Iraq. It's not going to win you any awards or prizes. You're not going to advance your career by defending the Iraq War. I think right now, you know, I said I had a final question for you, but you raised an important issue that I believe we probably can't ignore before we end this, and that is to say, the U.S. government is taking a position that does make it difficult for media workers. I think that when you look at the retaliation, it's not unfair to say that the stuff that people are dealing with in the workplace is a symptom of the fact that you have a U.S. government that is funding and providing weapons to the Israeli government. So, you know, as far as people working in Western media institutions, I know that the report covers like Canada, Germany, Australia, other European countries, the United Kingdom. These are all countries that are supportive of these actions. So for reporters and writers to be on the other side of this, it becomes difficult because this is a very powerful coalition that has decided to stand up in support of Israel.
Yeah, that's true. But I feel like, you know, there are two things that journalists are supposed to do. And these are like the two basic things, and that is reporting on the truth and, you know, holding powerful people accountable. Like a lot of us sort of got into this business because we were either obsessed with Watergate or obsessed with other stories of journalists, you know, holding powerful people to account. And so as we mentioned, like when it comes to Iraq, was that it's sort of similar in the way, like, you know, a lot of journalists supported what was going on in Iraq in the beginning. Now I think it's a whole different story, but like particularly in the beginning, they supported it and they even, you know, tried to push for it. Going back to the New York Times, like there was a whole Judith Miller incident. Sorry, I apologize.
Yeah, I know exactly.
And so it was the same thing of like supporting, like instead of doing your jobs and actually holding the U.S. government accountable and like, why are we going to Iraq? What does does Iraq have weapons of mass destruction? You know, asking these questions, we sort of supported it. And we, like, I do think there's also the issue of, like, you know, journalists being embedded to with the U.S. military. That is, to me, like, I always found very uncomfortable. Like, even when I was a kid, like, it just, there's something about that. Like, when we talked about objectivity, I feel like that really does affect like objectivity, like even like your like, you know, how journalists talk about objectivity, I think that even goes against that, because you are like inherently supporting and it can be easily propaganda. And we do see this again with Israel, where like one of the problematic issues is that like no international journalist is allowed to enter Gaza. Both, you know, Egypt and Israel has banned that. And so, and the only way you can go like in the Israel side is if you're embedded with the Israeli government. But of course, the issue with that is that it can be easily like, you know, propaganda. And you do see this with the report that CNN covered. I do think, like, you know, circling back, that even though, yes, these are powerful countries, like our jobs is to hold these powerful countries accountable, that they need to answer to us as, you know, constituents and as people that they're going to, that we're going to elect them in future elections. And so it's very important as journalists that we do our jobs in holding them to account and not, you know, supporting them or, you know, become propaganda in any way.
Well, and the flip side is that if we don't push back and do anything to resist the censorship or the suppression of people's work, that then it can become normal that the act of banning. Well, the more extreme example being that Al Jazeera was banned from being able to exist as a news network in Israel. You know, it's been labeled a Hamas mouthpiece without any evidence being put forward by the Israeli government. And that's an extreme example by a party in the war, but what's to stop institutions in the US, Canada, Australia, United Kingdom from taking that approach if there isn't organizing in defense of people's freedom of expression?
Yeah, definitely. I felt like the Al Jazeera one was so, I feel like sets a, such a dangerous precedent, because like, as you mentioned, like, what if they're like any then country can do the same thing? Like, they could take Israel's lead and be like, okay, like, well, I'm going to ban, I don't know, like the New York Times, the Washington Post, whatever. And that they are not allowed to enter the country. Like, you know, Russia could take this, or like literally any dictatorship can view this. And so we do need to, like, as journalists, do ask ourselves, like, what dangerous precedent this could lead to other countries. Like this does have, like, a ripple effect that, like, that people can take this and be like, oh, I can swing this anyway. And that is very dangerous. I do think, sorry, just circling back on the conversation about, like, power, like accountability, one thing that has given me hope is the way student journalists have been covering these encampments and how they are holding accountable their, you know, institutions and the police that have been coming in to break these encampments. And so they do give me hope of a journalism that is sort of, it supports the basic tenets of our industry, does a good job holding powerful people accountable and reporting on the truth.
Anything to tell people who are out there, writers, journalists, people who experience this? Is there anything that the National Writers Union tells them, especially if they're freelancers, I suppose? Mm-hmm. What do you say to them if they're going through retaliation? Mm-hmm. Should they turn to the National Writers Union?
Yeah, definitely the National Writers Union is a great place. Unfortunately, with freelancers, we don't have the bargaining rights that a staffer at a union has. This obviously has a lot to do with antitrust laws. And so unfortunately we don't have that. But what we do have is that we could collectively work together to change the industry. You know, we as a union have done many projects regarding, you know, the Freelance Isn't Free Act, and, you know, working on projects regarding changing rates. And obviously when it comes to solidarity with Palestine. And so there are a lot of projects that we are working on as a union that we care about that you can get involved in. Of course, if you have if you're a staffer working at, you know, and working at a news outlet and you have a union sort of addressing this issue like head on, that saying like, you know, journalists are being retaliated against, this is wrong, we should do something about it, and make sure to sort of bring it, like, make sure to say to, like, union management that this is an issue that we should all be against and that we should all, you know, really fight for the protection of journalists. You know, journalists should not be retaliated against for speaking out, for speaking up about any view that they support or agree with. And so that's like, that's a couple of ways that we could all, you know, protect, like, freedom of speech and the press within our unions.
Thank you so much. It's been really good speaking with you.